Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie, and this is the Reason Podcast. Today I'm joined by Catherine Manger Ward. She's the editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine. Catherine, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Nick.
And Matt Welch, editor-at-large of Reason. Matt is speaking to us from the West Coast, the Left Coast, the Best Coast today. Matt, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Good morning from the LBC.
Matt, well, why don't we, rather than talk about the LBC, which would be everybody's first choice. Let's talk about the French election between Macron and Le Pen. What happened and why does it matter in your estimation?
So there was a four-way scrum for the presidency of France, and there was a possibility that it was going to be the, quote, far right, although I think it's kind of a meaningless or a term, National Front leader Marine Le Pen, and the kind of somewhere between Bernie Sanders and Hugo Chavez, far left, as championed by Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who was kind of getting to some of the same positions of Le Pen, just from a left wing point of view. So, like, let's get out of the EU, let's get out of NATO, let's do a lot of things like that, and let's bolster the welfare state. So that was the kind of nightmare scenario that France was grappling with. And there are two other candidates who are polling pretty well, too, conservative François Fillon and some other person whose name I'm currently forgetting. It's not important. Macron is the centrist in French parlance, which means he puts him to the left of the center in the U.S. Used to be a member of François Hollande's cabinet, but now he's staking out in a party of his own making. He doesn't really even have a political party. The best thing about him, and I think the reason why he will win very handily, is that he's young. He's 39 years old, and he also is not really from French politics. So he hasn't had enough time to be stained by the usual dumb corruption. That's one of the reasons why François Fillon, who's the kind of conservative in the race, got tripped up. He had a corruption scandal involving a taxpayer-funded job for his wife and all this stuff. So they averted the far right, far left showdown that people were worried about. Macron is he was a part of a French American society, that's probably similar to the Swiss American friendship society that I belong to. And so he's seen to be a little bit more kind of dynamic than all of that. And he will be a boring moderate in at least the sense of modern French politics. The overwhelming thing is that it's a rejection of the status quo. It's a rejection of just political parties in France. It's another reminder that the National Front, which has been with us now for 25 or 30 years and is kind of the prototype of Trumpian style politics, in that it's very nationalistic, it's against international institutions, it's pro-welfare state, it's more circumspect about using a military abroad. It'll get its best result in the runoff election when it comes there. But we've seen this before many times, where there's the National Front makes the finals, Le Pen makes the finals in the presidential race. The polite society in France freaks out, and then he, in this case, she gets thumped in the general election. I would presume that she will do much better than the previous Le Pens have done. Right now, I think Macron is polling at 25 percentage points higher than the nearest competition. France's economy has been moribund for a quarter century. For the first time in maybe recorded French history, there's just a net outflow of French people, including my wife, hundreds of thousands who have just left the country because they don't have any hope there. Nothing in this election does anything to stem that bleeding, but at least Macron is compared to most French politicians, willing to admit that economic policy up till now has not been good, and the solutions to it are not to go further down that direction, but at least to try to revisit some of their labor laws and things.
So
like that.
It's kind of interesting, though, where I guess the big point of interest outside of France maybe is that you have two people from either not really a party in Macron, and then Le Pen, who is from an outsider party, and however much most American libertarians would disagree with her stances. It's more evidence that the status quo is, that people are getting hip to the idea that the status quo is not working and they want something different. So in that sense, it's kind of absent the substance of the people involved, it's something like Brexit. It's people saying no to whatever is and kind of pushing for something different. And I guess you could say the same thing about Trump as well. We don't fully understand exactly how many people voted for Trump wanted exactly what Trump was selling, and it was just more that people were fed up with business as usual.
Yeah, imagine if Martin O'Malley was A, interesting, and B...
No can do. That is an impossible thing to imagine.
Yeah, that's like a soluble fish. It's a surrealistic impossibility.
Just like a sunny, youngish person with some background in the Democratic Party, but was just a total independent. That's kind of a Macron type. So,
and he's pro EU, right? In a way that Le Pen is not. And is that a big deal? I mean, obviously, England or Great Britain always had a more kind of contested relationship with Europe because of for historical reasons, and depending on who you talk to, Great Britain, the United Kingdom is part of Europe or it isn't, et cetera. France has always been, the history of Europe in many ways is the history of France and Germany, and France came first as a country. Is there, even among the Le Pen people, is there an interest in breaking away from the EU, or is it more, this the talk of sovereignty and, of maintaining borders and keeping out, immigrants, from non-French or Francophone countries?
Both Le Pen and Mélenchon, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, the kind of a Chavista running there, were strongly anti-EU and strongly, pro-sovereignty in their way. And but France is – the EU was created by France and Germany with a little help from the United States back in the day, because it was seen as a bulwark against creeping Soviet communism if they had a free market and trading coal and other things. So it's central to the French identity to be part of building Europe. And one of the shocks to the system that this election represented was that there were so many people willing to vote for multiple candidates and not just a Le Pen, saying we don't like that anymore. So the flight towards Macron will be in many ways, which I think is going to be pretty overwhelming, is going to be a way of saying we're not willing to go that far just yet. It's going to take more to get essential partner of Europe and a creator of modern Europe to exit it. It's always been seen in France, not just by the elites, that France will help assure its seat at the table by maintaining its role in shaping modern Europe, even if the de facto leader of modern Europe is Germany and specifically Angela Merkel.
Do you, Catherine, when you look at Europe, do you see is that Europe, is that America in 25 years, or do we, can we maintain, or, are we kind of, is the shadow of kind of dying civilization, and I guess we'll get to this later in the podcast as well, as if there is such a thing, but as it sweeps first across Europe, and where Europe becomes sclerotic, it becomes low growth, it becomes kind of low energy, I guess, to use a Trumpism. It goes across America and then it ends in Asia, which seems, and obviously Japan has been in the tank for 30 plus years. But, China is rising, India is rising. Are we doomed to repeat the kind of labor laws, the kind of welfare state, the kind of over-bureaucratization of life that seems to have taken hold in Europe?
I think there's a temptation always to make these trends look like, Vox style heat maps that sweep across the globe in an intelligible way. I don't necessarily think, we're the sort of search for metaphors for America or harbingers for America or something like that. I don't look to Europe for that. I think, the fact that right now it looks like they're going to pull back from the thing that we did of basically saying, fuck it, let's light it all on fire. I just don't think that signifies for our future. I do wonder if, if the sort of Brexit comparison will look overblown later. I mean, people were starting to say, oh my God, it's Frexit. It's going to be the Chavista and the Le Pen, against each other in a race to the bottom. And it looks like that's not going to happen. Now, of course, it may be that we are all once again having the punditry problem of, well, surely the unthinkable won't happen, and then maybe it happens. You know, I think that we should all be wary of saying things like, oh, there's no way Le Pen will win. But Matt is right that the polling is much, much stronger and different than it looked both for Brexit and for Trump.
Talk, Matt, if you could talk a bit about, you know, one of the things that is interesting about French politics is that the left in France, or I guess it's the left, but like somebody like François Hollande, the outgoing president, was quite, you know, adventurous in foreign policy, or you know, the French left, and in some cases the British left also are not shy about using military force or getting behind military force. And there's you know, a bizarre passage to my mind in Christopher Hitchens' memoir, Hitch 22, about, you know, how patriotic he felt when Thatcher bombed the Falkland Islands. You know, it in, you know, if the left in America is seen as always being kind of the pacifistic peacenik group, that's not necessarily the case there. But, you know, when you get to the extremes of the right or the left, they tend to be more isolationist. But what's the connection there between, you know, French leftism and a projection of military force?
Well, so the two major issues haunting this election, haunting French society by far, one is the aforementioned kind of ongoing, almost three decades economic malaise. Nothing works, 25% or more unemployment among young people, and that's been forever. But the other one has been terrorism. France has suffered just horrendous terrorism on its soil. I was there over Christmas, as I usually do, and it was just really striking to be in, you know, a beautiful downtown historical church in Lyon on Christmas, and have it not be full, and have three armed guards with machine guns outside. It's just a different vibe that you notice everywhere, a sense of that people aren't safe. There's a lot of kind of suspicion there. So I think that the sense of foreign policy is not necessarily come from a starting point of we need to project power abroad. There's leftover colonial hangover stuff. So they'll have interest in countries that they used to be part of running. There's more support for that type of thing. Mm-hmm. And then there's, you know, very strong opposition to certain projections of force by the United States and other countries. So it's kind of a mixed bag. But it starts from the point of what do we do about homegrown terrorism here, which is Islamic in nature. And it's oftentimes by people who are not refugees, but who are second generation immigrants. So that's the sense in which people approach foreign policy there. And it's a muddle. They don't know what to do with it. François Hollande is the least popular French politician in modern recorded history. And he got very tough on, especially in cracking down on civil liberties and in the wake of the major terrorist attacks, the Bataclan and elsewhere. And he started getting more aggressive abroad to try to fight ISIS. It didn't necessarily help with his popularity. It didn't kind of go anywhere in particular. So I think France is kind of mixed up on interventionism right now.
Yeah, it's, you know, the tradition, the history of terrorism. The first time I visited France was in 1987. And that was the first time, I forget exactly what the terrorism was, but Paris had been rocked by a bunch of buildings being blown up. By somebody. I can't remember what group or what the cause was, but that was the first time that I was walking around a city and there were guys with machine guns on every street corner, which was pretty freaky, to say the least. Catherine, in terms of immigration, because this, you know, this one of the things that seems to knit together a lot, you know, whether it's the Brexit, whether it's the Frexit, whether it's Trump's win, is anxiety around the issue of immigration. It's always fascinating to me that right-wingers in particular, conservative anti-immigrants, anti-immigrationists always point to Europe and they say, you know, we have nothing to learn from Europe, except occasionally they'll say, oh, well, you know, like Sweden has no corporate income tax or much lower rates, et cetera, so we should take that away. But they always point to Europe, which is singularly, uniquely bad at assimilating immigrants, and then saying this is what's going to happen to the United States. Is there, you know, is there a way from a kind of open borders libertarian perspective to persuade people that Europe's immigration problems are Europe's because they treat immigrants and have a completely different cultural identity related to blood and soil and newcomers than the United States? Is there any way to kind of, you know, do some jujitsu to make people feel more comfortable about America's immigration history, which in general has worked extremely well in terms of assimilating people?
You know, I think that the thing that you just described is true, but I also think it's incredibly ineffective as a rhetorical strategy. Like, I find when I'm talking to people who see Europe as a cautionary tale, it's very, very hard to make or frame an argument that is about why we are so different than Europe. And I wonder if that's at least in part because the vision of the United States that the current kind of anti-immigrant crowd has is, I think the sort of smartest version of it, at least, is so heavily predicated on the idea that the reason America is a success is because of our Enlightenment values, because of the values that our European founders brought and installed here, and then that we've been able to pass along to subsequent waves of people who have come here, and they see that as what's being under threat. So they sort of say, like, well, Europe had all these good ideas too, right? They had the Enlightenment there first, and still they have fallen, and so we are at risk for that too. Like, I think it's a sort of ideas have consequences argument, at least in part. But I also think in France, in particular, there's this weird kind of schizophrenia about, you know, a huge chunk of the population has just voted for a candidate whose policy platform includes restricting certain types of people from coming into the country just because they are of a different race, national origin, ethnic origin, religion. And also there are laws in France that are essentially, you can't say that. You can't have that idea and verbalize it. I mean, hate speech laws in France are serious business. And you know, the idea that people's speech is restricted, so the only way they can express those views is by voting, strikes me as a really poisonous setup. And I think that's true in other European countries as well, to differing degrees. And it's not true here. So that's one place where we do have a difference. You know, people voted for Donald Trump for a lot of reasons. Some of them voted for Trump for this reason, but there were so many others. And I think, you know, reasons Robbie Suave wrote this post on the evening of the election that you know, political correctness and restricted speech are the reason Trump won. And I think it's certainly one of the reasons Trump won, but I think it's a bigger reason that Le Pen did as well as she did.
Matt, you're dialing in from Southern California, and you know, which was ground zero in among the many places where Mexicans who were the target of Donald Trump's official announcement, you know, Mexicans were the problem. They were coming here, bringing drugs, et cetera. You know, is there? I mean, the Arab question in France, which has if not dominated French discourse since it invaded and took over Algeria in the 19th century, has been a major, major issue. And it's not just Arab, but it's specifically Muslim, a different civilization coming to the country in large numbers and whatnot. Is that seems totally at odds, really, with Mexicanism, right, in America, because it's Mexicans are Catholics, the plurality of Americans are Catholic. Particularly in Southern California, do you see people kind of blending, like, that Mexicans are as distinct from real Americans, meaning, you know, a couple generations back, people from Europe that nobody wanted here anyway, you know, blending Mexicans with Muslims in the way they do in Europe?
It was interesting to watch the kind of evolution of anti-immigrant politics and rhetoric in the United States, just even in the last 20 years, because 15, 16 years ago, there was a strong attempt among restrictionists to make two claims. One of them was to do exactly as you said, say, hey, look, you know, there's the Iron Triangle down in Brazil somewhere, and that's where the secret Muslims and the secret Mexicans are colluding together. Michel Malkin's book that came out, his name I'm blanking on, but it was an immigration book after 9/11, was all about the how the kind of comparatively porous southern border is allowing for the possibility of the next Muslim extremist to come up there. There was a kind of a real fear, and then it was stoked by, I think, some fanciful Snopesable email forwarding chains about Muslims crossing over the border. That was one. And then the other element to it was back then, but not now. Interesting enough, there was a lot of talk about the Reconquista, yeah. Right? There's a lot of talk about like, si, you know, si. Do you know what La Raza really means? That means the race. Okay. Yes. All right. So people were getting really, really excited about the kind of, 1968 bylaws of campus Chicano organizations and what that's spelled out. And there were maps and all these kinds of things. You don't hear that anymore because it's even more ridiculous now than it was 15, 20 years ago. For one, you have just a disproportionate number of Latinos in the armed services, which is kind of difficult to grapple, including illegal immigrants and people that have been deported since their service, which is something that we've written about on our site a few times. And it's just it's absurd on its face if you are in certain parts of the country. I mean, if you just go to a Dodger game and who's a Dodger fan? What does the Dodger fan look like? It's kind of absurd to imagine that there's this separate kind of a hostile invading race called the Mexican that's different than the red. That's who
you're
is.
Not it's saying that Fernando Valenzuela wasn't the Kim Philby of Major League Baseball, the advance agent.
Don't give my my Dodger friends ideas there, but it's interesting to watch that argument kind of fall by the wayside and being replaced by new arguments, which are in fact old ones that are more about like the impact on the welfare state and all these kinds of things. So you no longer have that. I think they've crossed into when Fox was having a cartoon series called Border Town, we've kind of crossed into a line of assimilation where you're going to have to come up with arguments that don't have to do with the fundamental unassimilability of a group. Now that has transferred mostly to Arab Americans and Muslim Americans and not Mexicans.
But who are in tiny numbers, relatively speaking. It's like 1% of the population is Muslim here. But I Googled Michel Malkin's book. It was Invasion, How America Still Welcomes Terrorist Criminals and Other Foreign Menaces to Our Shores.
If I can just jump in with an anecdote. I went and saw Michel Malkin speak about her book, which I was interested in maybe 2003. In like a little bookstore in Westwood here, and to sort of see what she had to say. And she led with all of the, this is making us vulnerable to Islamic terrorism, and here's why. And the crowd, it was very interesting to watch because they're like, yeah. And then as soon as they got into Q&A, they're like, and did you see, I went by a strip mall and there wasn't a single word in English on those signs. And people are like, yeah. And they're like, yeah, I had to press 2 for English. Yeah. That it was kind of a wake up call to me that what was driving the passion out there was a cultural and kind of like my town is changing lament. It was not at all about the actual vulnerability of the thesis of the book, which is interesting.
Yeah, well, I was out in L.A. when Prop 187 was being voted on in the mid-90s. And that was, Matt, that I think was probably the high water mark of the Reconquista talk. And it was definitely not even hidden or implicit, but explicit of the idea that Southern California in particular was changing from this Beach Boys idol of impossibly blonde and blue-eyed and white-toothed people who had moved there after World War II, or maybe during World War II, and had participated in the great expansion of wealth, that Southern California was being changed and it was becoming browner, to be quite honest, and that was unsettling. And I kind of get that because I can understand that in the same way that I know when my grandparents showed up in the U.S. in the teens, and you know, and then lived through also through the same period on the East Coast. That's what people were most freaked out about. That suddenly you had a bunch of people who, you know, spoke different languages, ate different foods, worshiped different gods, drank different beverages, and. You know, I mean, it's in a way I don't, I have no stomach for xenophobia, but it's also, you know, I guess, and, we can end this, section on this, Catherine, is there a way to assuage people like that? Or do you just have to, as, John Mackey of Whole Foods is fond of saying, that social progress takes place one funeral at a time? I mean, is there a way to kind of invent or to, push a cosmopolitan spirit that is not at the cost, the expense of nationalism or patriotism, but where people who are used to one kind of world can be okay with a different world that has different people in it, but also different opportunities and good things in it? Or is that just a pipe dream?
I think that the one funeral at a time strategy is probably not the only one available to us, although sometimes it can feel that way. I mean, I think the gay marriage, the evolution on gay marriage is a good example of this, that, you know, you might have said that was true about gay marriage, but once there was a tipping point, people come around. And I think it's more about how to create this tipping point, how to create a general feeling of, maybe it's not so bad.
What I'm getting from you then is that we should have forced marriages between older white people and younger Mexicans?
Yes, that's right. That's right. If everybody married a Mexican, then they would see that they're an asset to the country. No, I mean, but this actually is, I think, you know, one reason why Reason is repeatedly editorializing about why we should make it easier for immigrants to work on the books, and to bring their families here. Because that, if it's true, although there's been a sort of social scientific kerfuffle about just how true it is, but if it's true that just seeing people who are different than you and seeing them doing things that look normal and familiar in your neighborhood is the most powerful force for assimilation or for acceptance or toleration, then by saying to people who come here, you have to stay below the radar, off the books, you can't bring your family, your heart has to stay in Mexico or in Kenya or wherever your family is, you know, we make it harder for that mechanism to work.
We're not talking about Obama anymore. Okay.
So yeah, Mexico or Kenya. Yeah, that's right. Long-form birth certificate is still coming. But no, I think that's true, though, that if you saw people in your neighborhood living a life just like your life, it would be the easiest and fastest way for people to be more tolerant of immigrants. And I think toleration is a virtue. I don't think it's just a practical question. I think it's also a moral question.
Wow. Well, you know, one of the reasons why all of these strains are particularly intense right now is, and I think we were talking about this in the context of the French election, but is economic growth or a perceived, real or perceived lack of resources, particularly government resources. We're looking, you know, because it's, late April, of course, you know, just like in late February and next February, next April, we're going to be looking at a government shutdown. As Trump closes out his 100 days in office, Matt, what is the latest? You've been following a lot of political shenanigans. You have a great cover story in the most recent issue of Reason about Trump as a deregulator. But what's going on with the government shutdown now, and what are the odds that you would give that we actually have some kind of stoppage of government money flow for even 24 hours?
I predict it'll be a 3-hour government shutdown. It's going to be 3 a.m. After April 28th, April 29th, it'll happen. It's amazing to me that we are here, and it's a real indictment. People will say it's an indictment of Trump, and I understand that. And you should, you know, just blame presidents for everything. I get it. But my God, Paul Ryan, what was the point of Paul Ryan in life at some point, right? Republicans took the Senate in 2014. And one of the things that they were supposed to do under unified Republican Congress was pass budgets. According to the Budget, I think, Control Act or something, Congressional Budget Act of 1974, you're supposed to pass a dozen appropriations bills throughout the year. You go through a process, you have hearings, and you do things. That's what Republicans were supposed to do because they were the serious party, of course, about fiscal procedures and all this kind of stuff. They haven't done jack shit. They just have not. And it didn't get any better as far as the naked eye can tell when they got a Republican president as well. So instead of being able to work on any kind of large scale thing like replacing, modifying Obamacare, or big tax reform or an infrastructure bill or anything, they're actually going to get to the precipice of a government shutdown. And it's going to be, to connect it to the previous discussion, sounds like the fight is going to be over a border wall funding. Mm-hmm. Trump issued a tremendous tweet yesterday saying that, well, Mexico will pay it in the future, just like I said, but in the present, what we're going to do to jumpstart it is that we need Congress to act right now. And so he's going to have to ask for some billions of dollars of spending to pay for this wall, and Republicans are going to be in a bind because they don't want to add a net amount of spending, but it's inevitable that I think that they will, either in this budget or in whatever kind of end of the year cromnibus we get passed in December or September, or whenever the next deadline comes up. I think inevitably they will end up spending more money than we saw under Obama. So it's just it's remarkable that we're in this place under unified Republican control, in which they're going to be faced with another shutdown instead of actually just doing any kind of business. Congress doesn't want to work. It just doesn't want to govern in any identifiable way at all. So you get into must-pass situations, and that's where a lot of kind of wickedness happens in terms of stuff tucked into the budget. It's a terrifying abdication of responsibility and another sign why both political parties should be sent on the Japanese curve.
Yeah, it's I know back when Obama, I guess, briefly had part of Congress behind him, Kent Conrad, the who was from Montana, I guess, and was considered the Senator Kent Conrad. And he was like a budget genius. And I can remember these breathless interviews that he would give with people like Ezra Klein, then at The Washington Post. In 2009, 2010, about how, they just had a real crackerjack of a budget coming in and everybody's going to be surprised and it's so great and it's so great and it's coming, it's coming. And it never did. This is truly a bipartisan problem, although you're right, Matt, that the Republicans now can do what they want. And the fact that they refuse to even pretend is pretty stunning. I spoke some years ago about this because I was amazed that like Congress could get away with doing this, of just totally abdicating their, arguably their most basic function, which is to, pass legislation that enables the government to function. And Norm Singleton, who all of us know, who now works for Campaign for Liberty and was Ron Paul's legislative director when he was in Congress, he said that it is, that it the minute that they kind of Congress realized they didn't have to do this work, because it's a lot of work, and nobody is probably that happy with the outcome, they did it and they had to vote and it was hard work, and they just realized, like, why bother if you don't have to? And it's kind of terrifying. But Catherine, do you see any way off of this, just endless kind of deferral into continuing resolutions, debt limit increases, you name it? Like, where is there anybody, or how do you get back to a point where you say, okay, we're actually going to say the government is spending this much this year definitively, and we're actually going through priorities, and we're saying we're going to spend money on this, but not this, and this, but not this?
Actually, Veronique Durugy is the person who finally cemented my despair on that front. She had a column for us maybe 3 years ago where she just outlined all the ways that Congress has attempted to bind its own hands over the years to limit spending, to fix the process, to, okay.
I mean, this
if
is
a
what
happens,
sequestration.
E.
Yeah, this is what sequestration essentially came about after, as the poison pill. That was so poisonous that, they would have to pass a budget in order to avoid having to make minimal cuts for a
and
couple
of years. And then this group of, quite intelligent people collectively easily figured out how to work around it. I mean, there was for a minute sort of some cuts which have had essentially no lasting impact, and nor has the structural threat of a sequester or shutdown had any lasting impact. I don't know. I don't know that there's a way out of this. Congress, you know, puts on its own handcuffs and keeps the key every single time. So I just don't see a way out. I think, you know, the way out is probably something like what's described in Lionel Shriver's novel The Mandibles, where we have a total collapse of the economy because no one wants to hold U.S. debt anymore, which is not a great way out. I'm not too excited about that as an option. But I actually wanted to go back to the wall for a minute and note that those Trump tweets, he also is tweeting exclusively about stopping drugs and gang members from coming into the country, which is just more of this weird slippage between, oh, we need the wall because benefit seekers, or they're going to ruin our culture, or probably terrorists, to, oh, you know what, actually, none of that is real at all. But drugs are real, and we can sort of show a stack of heroin that we confiscated at one of these border checkpoints. So let's go with that. Yeah, it's about drugs. It's drugs and gangs. And the sort of always slide from national security to drug enforcement is totally apparent in today's tweets or yesterday's tweets.
Well, at least Trump is, you know, he wants good American gangs to get back on top. So less MS-13, more Hells Angels or the Mongols. Matt, if you have...
Although I will say I Wikipedia'd MS-13 because I was like, oh, maybe I should know more about this gang that we're building a billion-dollar
board.
Well, the Wikipedia entry says that they originated in Los Angeles. So really, it's made in America.
But it's clever branding. It's like Hollister, where they have a whole fake backstory about.
I thought MS-13. We are never citing Hollister as an example of good branding. We're not doing that.
Yeah. All right. Well, you know. But no, I thought MS-13. But aren't they mostly El Salvadoran?
Yeah, they are. But the Wikipedia entry is careful to note that while it is ethnically Central American, it was established Los Angeles.
All right. So that is Matt. If you had to join a gang, what gang would you join?
I would join my fellow Mexicans in a gang called the White Fence. They tried to assimilate themselves in a gang here in Southern California.
The White Fence, and they tried to. So there were Mexicans, and they tried to create a white gang.
It's just that it's the name of it for whatever reason, and I presume just because it fits into the Nick Gillespie theory of The Godfather and how as soon as you become an organized crime member depicted in popular culture, that means you have assimilated.
Yeah,
I wanted it to be part of that story, even if I don't know whether it is.
Fence in question is a fence around a church. So there you go.
Okay, so itchy
trigger finger on the Wikipedia.
Yeah,
I'm all up in the Wikipedia today, you guys. I Wikipedia, so our listeners don't have to.
Yeah, it's Matt is referring to my theory that and this actually came out of the rise of gangster rap in the late '90s, and when Snoop Dogg in particular came out with the Dogfather using the. Calligraphy from The Godfather, and he and his cohort dressed up in mob suits. But the idea, which I think is pretty much true, and I'm going to play the next step of it here, is that once a subpopulation in America or an ethnic group takes on and starts to play with its identity as a criminal element in American society, that's a sign they fully assimilated. And for Italian Americans, when you look at in the early 60s, there were memoirs by mobsters who talked openly about La Cosa Nostra and the mafia and whatnot. And then, of course, The Godfather, the novel in 68 and the movie a couple of years later as a major cultural touchdown that recast the Italian American, this mythic idea of, you know, coming here as a gangster and then getting your kids into legitimate businesses, that was a sign that Italians had fully assimilated. I think when you look at something like The Dogfather, that was almost the last time that we really talked a lot about black crime, because it did start shifting very quickly into, no, it's really the Hispanics are the problem. So I guess what we need is a Jimmy Smits, Edward James Olmos and Lou Diamond Phillips' multi-generational epic about an L.A.-based crime family, Matt. I don't know if that has happened yet, but
you know, just called Zoot Suit 2018.
Oh, that would be, yeah.
And be done with it.
Yeah, the Zoot Suit Riots, fascinating phenomenon, that's for sure. Well, we'll leave that there. Let's talk about hate speech, because it's Monday. It's Hate Speech Monday. This is the week of the bitch is back. Supposedly Milo Yiannopoulos and Ann Coulter are going to be speaking at a Berkeley free speech event sometime in the next 1,000 years or so. And what was interesting are the reactions to the idea of having, you know, jackass college speakers. On the one hand, just limiting to the tiny state of Vermont, Bernie Sanders, the senator from Vermont, says, you know, that people like Ann Coulter have a right to speak on campus or to be heard on campus, whereas the former Vermont governor, Howard Dean, says no. Catherine, what's going on here among people that are kind of on the left side of the spectrum in American politics?
This is, I suppose, the Europeification of America. I mean, that this trend is easier, I think, to pin on Europe than the general anti-immigrant or fear of immigrants. This is the idea that you know, we have free speech, but let's be reasonable. It can't be speech that is scary or bad, as if that's not the entire point of free speech. And the place that this always happens, and this actually, Twitter, I think, has accelerated the stupidity of this particular argument, maybe almost to warp speed now. Somebody says something dumb like hate speech is not protected by the First Amendment. That is a not true statement. Then they realize it's a not true statement and they scramble for legitimacy. In this case, it was Howard Dean who said that stupid, not true statement. And they always wind up with the Chaplinsky case. I don't actually know if I'm saying it right. Chaplinsky, probably, which is the Supreme Court's 1942 case in which we established this idea that maybe when you're about to incite violence, there are limits on speech. The Supreme Court hates that precedent. They do not go back to it. They do not refer back to it. They rarely do anything other than restrict it further every time they are given the opportunity. But it's the thing that smart people do when they accidentally say something dumb, which is the First Amendment does not protect hate speech.
So that's kind of that's a fighting words case, I assume, where if it's you can restrict speech if it's a direct incitement to violence or is likely
exactly.
to lead to it. Yeah.
And that's, you know, this is what Howard Dean is somehow implying. And then when he's called out on it, he goes digging for, you know, through Ann Coulter's vast archive of stupid shit to see if he can find anything that looks anything like something that would line up with the Chaplinsky precedent. And he winds up digging up like one tweet from 2016 where Coulter says, "I would like to see a little more violence from the innocent Trump supporters set upon by violent leftist hoodlums." Like advocating self-defense by idiots from idiots is not, in fact, fighting words in any sense of the doctrine.
Matt, do you worry about speech on campus?
I don't know. You know, I mean, it's clear that it's a trend. It's clear, I think, that the trend is growing. Just in talking to people who are, you know, editors of alumni magazines, people who focused on this, I always ask, like, how much of this is, you know, we're cherry picking individual episodes on campuses and overblowing the importance of it, or how much do you just observe things like this increasing? And to a person, in this, regardless of where they sit on the political spectrum, they say, no, it is increasing really noticeably, really over the past 2 or 3 years. Interesting, there was kind of a conflation, I had this described to me, of kind of ongoing political correctness kind of issues like this on Berkeley, and then that mixed with the kind of Black Lives Matter moment and intersectionality. Somewhere in all of that, there's sort of a stew that has produced a sharp uptick in things like this. What I don't know is how much of this matters. I mean, I went to UC Santa Barbara. It was a student body of 18,000 undergraduates at the time. And I worked at the college newspaper, and we would do what college newspapers do, which is write about the student government as if the student government mattered. And there'd be all these kind of disputes, and some of them were actually free speech disputes. I wrote a column for Reason a few years back obviously attempting to claim that the modern day free speech battles were all started at UC Santa Barbara when I was there. But the thing is, all of this activity and the debates and the should we allow, you know, Blue Velvet to be shown on campus, or is it violence against women, that kind of stuff. All this is a conversation happening between 500 people on a campus of 18,000. In fact, 8,000 or so of those people are all in fraternities and sororities, and they're doing what you would expect students at UC Santa Barbara to do, which is occasionally go to school, but mostly drink pitchers of Bud Light and play volleyball and graduate in 6 years. It's easy to get caught up in this is all really important, and this defines the campus experience as we know it. And I think it just doesn't. So, yeah, I'm worried about it. It's the culture of free speech in this country, I think, is eroding in ways that is genuinely alarming. And this is part of it. And hearing it from Howard Dean is part of it. And just every time you see, you know, the reaction to Charlie Hebdo being massacred, you know, people choosing that as a moment to go in and try to figure out, well, you know, they were engaged in hate speech, they were punching down, all this kind of crap. There is a sickness in the way that different parts of the political spectrum are dealing with free speech now, and I'm worried about that. But I'm worried about something else, or I should say, and I'm worried about something else, because I don't want it to be sounding like a but. Mm-hmm. And it's this: how many decades more are we going to have this stupid cycle in which Ann Coulter and Milo Jakadopoulos and anyone else in the next generation's David Horowitz are going to say stupid collectivist bullshit and then get rewarded for it in the conservative marketplace and rile up college students as part of the process? There's something really unseemly about a movement that rewards someone who is, even while being funny on occasion and while being personable in green rooms, is really just kind of a collectivist nonsense person in Ann Coulter. And the fact that this has been a successful line of work for a long time for a lot of different people shows a sickness, I think, in contemporary conservatism that is worth also discussing in addition to the reaction that it provokes, which is illiberal and very troubling.
I would like
also the eternal recurrence of Ann Coulter specifically is impressive at this point, right? Like, how many rounds of this have been pegged to Ann Coulter herself? I remember when my sister was an undergrad, so sometime in the early aughts, she, like, I don't know what we were even using there. She AOL instant messaged me to say Ann Coulter was coming to her campus and all of her friends were boycotting and what should she do? So this is forever. And in fact, it's been going on so long that people have now forgotten parts of even the history of Ann Coulter. The Washington Post published a story yesterday. Ann Coulter finds an unlikely ally in her free speech spat with Berkeley, Bill Maher. The idea that Ann Coulter and Bill Maher are unlikely allies in this world shows that, like, we've now gone a full generation from when this shit started. And we are still in it. So, you know, whether or not, like, Milo steps up to be the new Ann Coulter in the long run, I have no idea. But we don't even need a new Ann Coulter. She's doing fine. She can do this for another 30 years.
You know, and actresses complain there's no roles for older women.
That's right.
I wanted to go back to the idea which sent a shiver of fear down my spine in something that Matt said when he mentioned that he knows a bunch of people who edit alumni magazines. That's got to be the worst. Could you imagine? Like, I mean, managing or editing a college alumni magazine, like, you know, and I would love to know how Temple, you know, what did the Temple alumni magazine, what kind of shrieks of horror went through their offices when Bill Cosby was revealed, you know. And
all I know is that the UC Santa Barbara alumni magazine about a year and a half ago had a big spread of, like, gauchos who have made it in the media.
Oh, and please, wait, Matt, explain to all but the, you know, people who follow Division III sports that with gaucho, you're not making some kind of ethnic slur on, you know, subsection.
That would be amazing, though, if your alumni magazine just ran a spread of, like, like, sorted by ethnicity of people who were successful.
In the UC system in particular, there's a lot of ridiculous names. So UC Irvine are the Anteaters, Santa Cruz are the Banana Slugs, and Santa Barbara are the Gauchos.
So the Gauchos, you're still mad because you did not make their parade of Gauchos, right?
Harris Faulkner got a lot of ink in that story, and certain people on this phone call did not. Yeah. So
but
I'm
Sean Hannity and Michael Douglas are the two big UCSB alums.
Hannity didn't actually go to UC Santa Barbara. He broadcast at KCSB as an outsider, but he wasn't an actual student. Jim Rome, I believe, was a UC Santa Barbara student. Yes, he was, definitely. So he's probably the most successful broadcaster. Steve
Saban.
In
the UC system, is there a kind of Berkeley envy? So if Berkeley gets Ann Coulter, you know, and shuts her down, then, you know, you UC Santa Barbara tries to get Ben Shapiro and shut him down. Is there any kind of, you know?
I mean, everybody's still trying to get Charles Murray to come back. That's another one that's like, how many decades of campus protesting, of speech giving can we have of Charles Murray? Apparently at least one more.
And, you know, it's kind of interesting when you think about it in those terms, Catherine, because David Horowitz, who Matt mentioned, and was like the undisputed king, heavyweight champ in, I guess, in like the 90s and early aughts, he's totally faded. Nobody, you know, he can't get arrested on a college campus these days. So it's, what is it about these people that, you know, that, I mean, how do they stay at the top of their game for so long? It's pretty impressive.
In fairness, I think Horowitz has been near death for a while.
You know, Matt, I think it was my, my parish priest told me that we start dying the minute we're born. So come on, you got to come up with something better.
Also, Ann Coulter has pretty clearly been near death for decades as well.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow.
This is all hate speech.
Is there?
Luckily for us, it's protected.
Will there ever come a time where? You know, where people who are free speech advocates, and this includes, you know, people, you know, who are more liberal, like the ACLU or even on the far left or in the libertarian right, where we actually get to defend people whose speech we agree with? Or is that just asking for too much? Because, and again, I think like both of you, I've been on various shows with Ann Coulter, and she's extremely nice in person. I think she can be very funny. I think that she's a performance artist more than anything else. But, like, you know, her books are terrible. I debated her once in Colorado, and she was like, well, you know, the problem with libertarians is all you talk about is drugs, and you don't talk about things like, you know, the budget. And so then I would try and steer the conversation to the budget, and she'd be like, the problem with you libertarians is that you're all nerds, and all you care about is money, and you don't care about things like, you know, the destruction of the culture through drugs, et cetera. You know, I mean, she's not a serious person. And are we, you know, can we get to a point where colleges have actually serious people debating stuff that really matters, and that, you know, where there's actually a support for serious debate about serious topics? Or is that just, when I was in college in the 80s, first half of the 80s, the people who always got picketed were CIA directors. Ex-CIA directors would come to college campuses and do speaking tours, and then people would chant outside, you know, how awful they were in various ways, which is all good and proper. But then you would hear them and you would argue and debate. And, like, is that model of college speakerdom pretty much gone?
That I think we can get back. I mean, the idea of free speech zones, which is a stupid perversion of that concept, is one that campuses have tried and I think mostly failed. And mostly that idea has been rejected in the courts, thanks to the hard work of the people at FIRE. But, you know, this sort of idea of we get to take turns having our say, you do see. I mean, I see even in just my social media feeds, attempts, particularly between students, to actually talk. You know, you see the Campus Crusade for Christ or whatever they're called now, meeting up with the LGBT society or whatever they're called now to try and hash it out. And it doesn't necessarily go well, but it is a conversation. And I think this sort of escalated, you're not even allowed to talk in the lecture room where you were invited to speak thing will probably fade. But the idea that campuses are the right place for people with controversial opinions to express them, that, you know, maybe that has to go away. Maybe it has to be, if you want to bring Ann Coulter to your campus, you need to rent a private hall outside the campus and say, none of this is anyone else's problem. If you want to hear her, come hear her, you know, at the local community center or whatever. You know, that's the sort of libertarian opt-out. Maybe if this was all happening on private property, it was clearly defined entry and exit rights, this wouldn't be such a problem, but it's also a real answer.
Well, you know, also think about this. We recently interviewed Laura Kipnis, who Matt had interviewed for Reason a couple of years ago, and she's a journalism and film professor at Northwestern, who wrote an essay that offended some of her students on Northwestern. She wrote it in the Chronicle of Higher Education, and they launched a Title IX sexual harassment case against her, saying she had created a hostile environment on campus by talking about her past sexual experiences. She's a dyed-in-the-wool progressive leftist, and she has a great new book out called Unwanted Advances, which is kind of an exploration of the what she considers a star chamber, a witch hunt, hysteria, sexual paranoia on campus. I mean, that might be a sign that the pendulum is starting to swing back towards the center of the university as a place of free speech. But Matt, I think Catherine might be right that maybe and you were suggesting this, I think, as well, that if we're looking for colleges to be the place where free speech matters or free speech happens, why bother? There are so many other places, and it might be in the continuing kind of denigration of actual higher learning at universities. Of course, people with ideas, people with thoughts, people with interest in the future are going to flee and go elsewhere to have interesting conversations, because it's almost impossible to on a campus.
I mean, we've seen a few comedians. I think Jerry Seinfeld, kind of famously, maybe even Dave Chappelle. And I've just said, screw it, I'm not going on college campuses anymore. It's not worth it. It's not fun for me. I actually talked to quite a few comedians who hang out in the kind of Red Eye Kennedy circuit in New York, and they will report similar things. They don't enjoy talking to college students because they're humorless and they can't write up on the edge of the uncomfortable areas of comedy, which is where a lot of comedy kind of originates from. It's this weird paradox because people still enjoy consuming the fruits of controversial speech. There's always going to be a market for South Park. Dave Chappelle's show was recent Netflix special was a resounding success. People want this stuff. They want to go see the Book of Mormon. They want to be outraged, and they consume it and they love it. And yet, they're constantly policing those boundaries and deciding what's acceptable or whatever. It's a paradox, and I think maybe there is something to the as Johnny Rotten sang, "We're just another country," in "God Save the Queen." That universities are just another institution, and part of the foundational problems of that institution, as Jonathan Haidt has pointed out, and he's written a lot about this and talked about it, is just a monolithic sense of politics. And so, I live in a monolithic a political neighborhood in Brooklyn that went 92% for Hillary Clinton, and I think you see similar types of things like that in college campuses, except with more kind of academic Marxism thrown in to it on the professoriate side. And when you have monocultures politically, it's just going to produce stuff like that. And there's going to be a policing of what is acceptable and not. And there's going to be people who are very inflamed about on a one-sided basis. And I think people are just going to graduate away from the notion that the free speech zone is college campuses. No, the free speech zone, God help us, is Twitter and Facebook and our daily lives. So I think college campuses are going to be continue to be kind of de-emphasized as a place where you get challenged. And that's
well, thank God at Reason we don't live in a monoculture. We live in a thriving marketplace of ideas, from anarcho-capitalism to minarchism.
The full spectrum.
Yeah, plus another 360 degrees, just to make sure we didn't leave anything behind in the hotel room that we really, really want. Catherine, what do you think? Matt's comments put me in mind of one of the, and I can remember, I might have been in grad school at the, I don't know, it was like around 1987 or 88, something like that. And I'm also going to, I'll try and rehearse every meal I've had since then to get the details just right. But when Alan Bloom in the late 80s wrote The Closing of the American Mind, he and a former president or dean of Harvard went on a speaking tour together where they debated each other. And there have been stuff like this. Hitchens and Dinesh D'Souza used to do a dog and pony show like that about the existence of God some years ago. But it was kind of a fantastic thing to see two, you know, true eggheads kind of battling it out without dumbing it down for the audience. But the reason I think of Alan Bloom is because David Brooks, the New York Times columnist, had a piece recently which drew a lot of attention, saying that, you know, essentially what is happening, what we're seeing throughout the kind of West, throughout the developed world, is the erosion of belief in kind of Western narratives of faith and community and authority, and that's what's leading to our current issues. You are not particularly taken by that thesis, you know, yet it seems to be in evidence when we talk about things like free speech. One of the things the FIRE people say that's, you know, particularly frightening to them is that in the mid-60s, when the free speech movement at Berkeley started, it was students agitating for more freedom to speak. Now at Berkeley and everywhere else, you see students agitating for less freedom, even for them to speak, much less anybody else. You know, is Brooks wrong that we've, you know, that something fundamental has shifted and that we no longer believe in kind of Western virtues that help to, you know, create a world in which most people are living pretty good lives?
The fact that you had to do the grandpa-style journey back down memory lane to remember when this argument first started floating around, I think has the answer embedded in it.
This
I
mean, is this fascinating.
Yeah, tell me. I will tell you all about it. So basically, I think, you know, this idea of we are on the verge of collapse, Western values are being neglected, that in turn is producing a sort of soft, weak, non-virtuous American young person who will in turn go on to produce a soft, weak nation that the enemies of our state, whichever ones they are at that exact moment, will almost certainly crush brutally. People have been saying that. Alan Bloom had been saying that so many decades back, so many decades of this same argument. And I think it's really hard to argue, even though the specific trends that they point to and the specific points that David Brooks makes, even in this column, are not wrong. It's hard to argue that we actually right now, you know, sitting on, let's say, 50 years of making this argument, that our nation is in fact weaker, less virtuous, less prepared for our own national defense, less intellectually inclined. I just don't think it's true. I just don't see the sort of threatened consequence of this shift actually happening in the world. And Brooks says, well, you can see it in our emerging preference for authoritarian leaders. But, you know, I would argue that...
And yet Hillary Clinton lost. You know, what's she talking about?
Hillary Clinton lost, yeah. But I would argue also, if, to the extent that there is a emerging trend for authoritarian leaders, it's a blip. Certainly world historically, and even in the Western world, we our preference is universally away from authoritarianism, and it's not just something that's turned itself around all of a sudden so that we have to write 717 words about the end of Western civ and have everyone email it to each other.
Could some of it be true, though? I mean, like, it doesn't have to be a total decline. What you're talking about, you know, the people announcing, the decline of Western civilization, even as, you know, Western civilization is coming into being, is, you know, these are things that happen at the same time in ancient Greece and Rome. There's a particularly American version of it. Harvard professor, literary historian Sofvin Berkovich, talks about the American Jeremiad as the defining literary genre of America that started before the United States was, you know, when it was still colonies, of, you know, this is we are going to hell in a handbasket, and you better pay attention. And there's a lot of truth to that. But does it have to be all or nothing? Because in a way, and this is something that I want to keep a tight leash on myself on, but it becomes harder and harder to talk about how, well, maybe people aren't as intellectually minded as they used to be 30 or 40 years ago for a variety of reasons. It may or may not be a good thing, but, you know, maybe that's true, even if, you know, obviously we are, you know, we have better military weapons and we're better, you know, we're in better shape than we were 50 years ago. That's for damn sure. You know, physical shape. You know, does it have to be all or nothing, Catherine? Is it, or does that subvert Brooks's basic argument?
So I do think there's one thing in particular that struck me when I read Closing of the American Mind 10 years ago, and that was Alan Bloom's concern about our privileging of niceness, that it's more important to be nice than to be virtuous, essentially. And I do think what we're seeing with safe spaces and with the desire to restrict uncomfortable speech or speech that makes people feel alienated or upset, that is the apotheosis of this privileging of niceness, that it is important to have a world where everyone is pleasant and good to each other all the time, over and above a world in which we have the classical virtues, or in which we are prepared to defend the principles of self-government and democratic ideals. That's true, I think. But that has a corollary benefit that is its own virtue. And this is what we were talking about before, the virtue of toleration, which is different than niceness. And I think that goes hand in hand with a certain kind of intellectual openness that was historically much harder, if not impossible. You know, the idea that you can consider ideas that are so radically different than your own, not have to say, well, I either have to fully assimilate into that idea and that's the new standard universal across my society, or else I have to reject it completely. The idea that we would have a society where lots of different intellectual currents live alongside each other, I think that's become much more robust, and that's a positive change. And it's not, I don't think the loss of martial virtues is, if it's happening, it's not the panic that David Brooks has always believed that it is. David Brooks likes war. He has said this explicitly, and so have many other of his colleagues in the kind of vaguely neocon-o-sphere, because he thinks it will take all these young men who have become namby-pambies and toughen them up. And that is wrong and bad.
Matt, are you a wimpier man than your father?
As I speak, no. But that's also medical as much as anything else. Let's be clear about David Brooks. He's not anti-authoritarian. He is the new authoritarians aren't Brooksian. He is actually as pro-authoritarian as any commenter of stature on the modern American political scene. He has, you know, back in the late 90s, he was forever championing how we need a new Teddy Roosevelt in our lives to toughen us up. We need a project for national greatness. And it doesn't even matter what it is. Let's just do something to get the blood pumping again. So his crisis, which is, personal and societal, is that the new breed of authoritarian isn't this kind of enlightened, Churchill quoting, type that he prefers. It's this kind of messy, nationalistic, kind of a more inward-looking type. And this displaces the importance of David Brooks. And much of modern punditry, sadly and predictably, has to do with does the pundit himself or herself have a role in the power structure, or are they now on the outside looking in, and is there anxiety associated with that? So I share probably some of Brooks's concern about the new breed of authoritarianism for even occasionally similar reasons. But Brooks himself is the embodiment of a type of authoritarianism that and elitism in this country and in other countries, including France, which has discredited itself. The elites pooped on themselves and left us with a big mess. And so it's not altogether surprising that people started searching desperately for anyone who just sounded like not David Brooks. His crocodile tears are a bit delicious for me to swallow.
With your defecatory metaphor there, Matt, it calls to mind Larry the Cable Guy on Fox and Friends during the election. He was asked, who's he supporting? Because I think the host assumed that he'd be a Trump guy. And he said, this election is about whether or not you want to have somebody poop on you or you want to poop your own pants. And he said that's why he was voting for Gary Johnson, because he wanted to shit his own pants. To push back a little bit on both of your anti-Brooksian takes, which I agree with, is what is the minimal kind of lines of code for an operating system in American society, much less like the larger, however we're calling the West or the developed world or anything like that, the kind of limited government model where people are more or less free to live their own lives. What are the minimal commitments that we all have to share in order to maintain that, so we don't start becoming, somebody like Nigel Farage or Donald Trump, possibly even a Le Pen, they are not the same as Erdogan in Turkey or some of the some leaders in other countries. But what are the commitments that we have to maintain in order that either capitalism or freedom or anti-elitism doesn't swallow us whole and we become more of a kind of mobocracy where rights are very much in dissent and all of that kind of stuff? Do we need the commitment to tolerance, and can we have that if we reject all forms of elite tastemaking, gatekeeping? What are the things that we all have to agree on in order to have a society that doesn't completely fold in on itself?
So Brooks offers a list, right? In this column, he says, okay, we have to agree about the importance of reasoned discourse, the importance of property rights, the need for a public square that's religiously informed but not theocratically dominated. And right there, he's smuggling in an awful lot. I mean, I think the
notion... But
that's
kind of the American catechism, isn't it? At least the way it developed in the 20th century. Yeah.
The thing that he's rehearsing here is not like a wildly controversial characterization of what the sort of Western narrative about underlying political values looks like. But I don't know that, for instance, religiously informed but not theocratically dominated is a necessary condition. And I think, other people would say, well, if you have reasoned discourse, you don't need property rights. I mean, I think this is where you get in trouble with this type of argumentation, is that he's essentially saying, well, the reason we know this list is important is some combination of it was given to us on high from the ancients or maybe the Enlightenment or pick your sort of moment, and also because it's worked so far. If we want to be
fully honest, what he's really rehearsing there, and I don't think this is necessarily a criticism, but it's actually probably a post-World War II understanding of what reasoned discourse means. Because when you look back in the 19th century or even early mid-20th century, there wasn't a ton of reasoned discourse in American politics. There was open and overt racism. There was, all sorts of horrible things being said in the name of reasoned discourse. So it may – and we didn't have free speech or freedom from religion until, the 1960s in a lot of ways.
And even if you look at some of the most canonical defenses of a free press or of free speech, they're typically highly influenced by the idea that, for instance, atheists can't participate in that debate since their oaths are not trustworthy, right? I mean, so what religiously informed but not theocratically dominated looks like is also up for debate.
I know. I love, Milton's defense of the unlicensed press, which is really important, but Areopagitica, and he's like, and I'm talking about free speech rights only for Protestants because, those fucking Catholics, they're nuts. Like, they don't have these rights. So,
The idea that we are less virtuous than those people by almost any definition of virtue is a little tricky for me to swallow. And I think, again, just looking more broadly, if you really look across the last 50 years and see a people who have become significantly less free, less virtuous, like I guess I just don't see it. And maybe this is just as much of a kind of a Rorschach test. You know, maybe this is why people become Brooksian conservatives, because they look across the last 50 years and say, yes, there is obviously a decline. But it seems to me you can at least make the case that people have become better in many ways and certainly freer.
It's certainly, I mean, well, Matt, you would agree. I mean, I know we've co-authored a number of pieces that essentially make the case that Catherine is saying, is that, you know, the last 50 years are nothing to be ashamed of. In fact, that's when, you know, a kind of libertarian sensibility and a lived individualism rather than a kind of pious incantation of, oh, individual rights. But, you know, people started living their lives the way they wanted to more in the past 50 years than in the 50 years before that. It's kind of all gravy, really.
50 years ago, it was at least, I think, Loving versus Virginia was like exactly 50 years ago, like today or this week. So 51 years ago, it was still legal in this country for a state to ban interracial marriage, which is just mind-boggling that it happened at least in the lifetime of one person on this phone call, this was normal. And
this is slightly different, but it was only in 1984 that a majority of Americans said that interracial relationships were moral. So it's even, you know, it's even more recent in a lot of ways. If you get
people
out of
the
legal form.
People are terrified that good stuff happens without their fingerprints on it. This has broader applications than just discussions of national politics too. So David Brooks is trying to write rules for how we get there, because he's terrified that people might get there without his rules and without him saying it. I mean, you asked what are the minimum things that we have to agree on. A big part of me, especially now that I'm on the West Coast right now, is like, fuck your rules. We don't have to agree on anything, damn it. It's not true, of course. We do agree on a basic conception of free speech, which I think Deirdre McCloskey and others have argued is like the thing that started the Great Prosperity in 1800, arguably, or one of them. Free speech, basic capitalism, as opposed to communism or, you know, state having the lead role in the economy. And basic rule of law, and then we can haggle over the differences here and there. But that is the more or less the blueprint that every successful society has engendered, and we'll argue over details. And it's one of the reasons why people like us get overexcited on free speech issues, is that we understand, and rightfully so, that that is really one of the foundational kind of principles. But so is the notion of kind of a capitalistic commerce and private commerce out there too. You know, to be anxious that not enough people share those values gets you down to a kind of an Ann Coulterist thing. And you hear this a lot in immigration debates. It's like, we can't have all these Mexicans because they're voting wrong. They don't have the same values. You libertarians, you know, look at what happened to California. You let the Mexicans in and now they vote Democrat. And I just can't, I don't cotton to the essentialist kind of argument where, you know, that it all depends on how it translates into modern political votes. And I think if you have the basic troika of speech, commerce, and rule of law, you're probably not going to backslide into awfulness, and you're going to arrive at your own thing, regardless of the exertions of David Brooks. And his terror at that is interesting, and I think a lot of people are trying to wrap their heads around the unraveling of the post-war consensus, and I'm one of them of post-World War II consensus of you know, ongoing internationalization, ongoing lowering of tariffs, ongoing kind of multilateralism there. That clearly is being challenged right now, and that is that's a kind of upsetting for those of us who believe that that was part of an engine of progress that we have been enjoying. But to think to say that is a question of like our kind of internal Western civilizational values undergoing a threat, I'm not so convinced of that.
Well, we are going to leave it there. This has been the Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. We've been talking with Matt Welch, editor-at-large of Reason. Matt, thanks for taking part.
Thank you much.
And Catherine Manga Ward, she's the editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine, and you can subscribe to Reason Magazine at reason.com/subscribe. Catherine, thanks for talking.
Thank you.
For Reason, I'm Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening, and again, subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Thanks so much.